Welcome to Mind the Gap.
Here's what we do. We will set up. This is Tunnel Vision.
From planet to planet. Solar system to solar system. From galaxy to galaxy. React!
We switch you to Earth.
Come in, please.
Uncensored.
Copy, Skywatch, clear.
Another public service message from way out. We care about your world. Stay tuned.
Welcome, listeners. This is Mind the Gap, June 2016. Jason Vass here with...
Gus, I'm here too.
And we're here to share some art news and some cultural information and some other stuff, hoping that you are enjoying the show. That, as usual, is Jurassic 5 React, our opening number. So here we are. It's June in Los Angeles.
Yes, it's finally getting hot.
Yeah, well, not by the beach, but certainly inland. Warmer. It's been May gray and
well, just
still
today
June
was
gloom.
The first time. It's been beautiful. It's been socked in all spring.
Beautiful. Yeah, really wonderful. And we've got all kinds of things moving in the world. Election coming up here in California. The primary, Democratic and Republican. We've got basketball playoffs. We've got the end of the French Open, raining out.
The NHL Stanley Cup Finals.
We've got the Stanley Cup Finals. We've got a bunch of good stuff going on, and we've got art in LA.
Well, let's get to that.
Yeah, let's. So we've been talking about Doug Christmas and Ace Gallery, and there's been some new news on that front.
Goody, goody.
Yeah, so... Ace Gallery founder fired and facing possibility of criminal charges.
Uh-oh, that's worse than fired.
After facing legal claims by artists represented by the gallery seeking their works back and payment for works sold, founder of Los Angeles' Ace Gallery, Doug Christmas, has been terminated from the business by a court-appointed financial manager, according to John Finkel in the Art newspaper. Now, if you remember last month, he had a court-appointed trustee. He failed to make $17.5 million in bankruptcy payments, and they appointed a trustee, and he was in there, like, kind of smirking and going, everything's just fine, and now I can get to the real business and what you were handling it all along, but someone was managing it for him. So now he's been fired. The manager, Sam Leslie, is a forensic accountant who now runs the day-to-day operations of the gallery after it filed for bankruptcy, and he has filed a report documenting millions of dollars diverted from the gallery to mysterious accounts and dozens of works of art that have been moved to private storage. Leslie ended Christmas's role at the gallery after a review of Ace's financial records, noting that from February 2013 to February 2016, a total of $16,910,139 was directed to Ace New York, and of that sum, $4,568,382 was diverted to an entity known as the Ace Museum. Both companies are red flags, since Christmas closed the New York branch of his gallery more than a decade ago, and his so-called museum on La Brea Avenue in Los Angeles has not had a consistent history of exhibitions. Leslie also found that Christmas had instructed assistants to move 60 works of art from Ace Gallery to a private storage facility the day before Leslie took over management of the business. In his court report, Leslie said, quote, I asked Christmas to prove his ownership to me of those 60 pieces of art. He told me he had acquired them years before, and when pressed, gave me dates in the early 1970s and 1980s, and he confirmed all works he allegedly owns predated the year 2000 in any event. None of these pieces, including one of significant value, were listed in the bankruptcy petition he personally filed in 2004. The attorney who represented the painter Gary Lang in the Ace bankruptcy case, J. Scott Bovitz, says concealing assets in a case could result in criminal charges. Quote, if the artwork was in fact his personal property, Mr. Christmas didn't disclose it in his 2004 bankruptcy, and that's a problem.
It's a big problem.
If it wasn't his own property and he stole it from the bankruptcy estate this year, that's also a problem.
Also a problem.
Either way, he has painted himself into a corner.
Yeah, one,
unquote.
It's one or the other, right?
Bovitz noted that transferring money out of a bankruptcy estate may also be a crime, depending on intent. It is not clear, as of yet, whether a criminal investigation is underway. The gallery is still open with regular hours and some staff, and it will open a new exhibition on June 11th, including works by John Armletter, Mary Corse, Ian Hamilton, Finlay, Ben Jones, Janice Cornelis, Gary Lang, Robert Longo, and Julian Schnabel, among others.
Wow.
At its location on Wilshire Boulevard. Wow. So that opening is not this Saturday. Next Saturday is June 11th. And now I heard today, Scuttlebutt, just FYI, that none of the work is for sale, which makes no sense because they're raising money for the bankruptcy. So, Gus, I don't know. We'll be watching and following this story.
I'm just wondering how those artists feel right now. It's just like, wow, we got a big opening coming up in the spring?
No, this opening...
It's the summer. No, it's the spring.
No, it's the spring, but it's opening in June 11th, but... Are the works for sale? Are they not? We'll find out. We'll sort of move towards that as we move through this month. I got things to do that day. I don't know if I'm going to go to that opening. That's the same day, kids, that that the Made in L.A. 2016, the third iteration of the Hammer Museum's biennial exhibition, opens. That's a members opening June 11th, and I was going to go to that. It opens to the public June 12th. So that's something that there's a couple of other things opening on June 11th as well. And, of course, this Saturday, June 4th, which this show is airing the 5th. That'll be a big opening day as well. But so in next week on Saturday, we've got the Ace opening. Go to it on La Brea if you want. Check out the scene without Doug Christmas. And as well, if you can get over to the Hammer, and get in on a members opening for that. Made in L.A., 6 to 10, should be fabulous. It's an important show in L.A., and certainly to the public starting June 12th. So we've got some other news about L.A. This one I found. This is dated May 20th. Marciano Art Foundation set to open L.A. Museum in 2017. According to Janelle Zara of Art News, the Marciano Art Foundation announced that its private LA Museum will open early 2017. The 100,000 square foot museum will be located, will be housed in a former Masonic temple, which the guest co-founders and brothers, Maurice and Paul Marciano, bought in 2013 for $8 million. There's that picture. I don't know if you know where that Masonic temple is. It's like, you know,
where is it again?
It's like Culver City Century somewhere. You know, it's it's a big sucker. It's 100,000 square feet. They bought in 2013 for $8 million, as ArtForum.com previously reported. I had heard that that was shelved, done, going to open, going to close. I mean, you know, it's so much for the last 3 years, but now they're saying it's going to open next year. Renovations are being led by the California-based architectural firm Y. That's small W, capital H-Y, which said the space is being redesigned for the display, research, performance, and making of contemporary art, and will include an open storage archive and a young artist forum. Philip Kaiser, curator of the Swiss Pavilion at the upcoming 2017 Venice Biennale, and a former senior curator at Los Angeles's Museum of Contemporary Art, will curate the museum's inaugural exhibition. Maurice and Paul Marciano began collecting art around 1990. According to the New York Times, between the brothers' personal collections, their joint collection, the guest collection, and their Art Foundation's collection, they own approximately 1,000 pieces of art. So that's a little bit of L.A. news. There might be some other stuff that's related to L.A., but I think that's kind of pretty much a quick update on that. So now we're going to jump to some other art world news. And this one's about Damien Hirst's show of Jeff Koons at his museum in London. And just, I thought it would be interesting to share this. So the title of this article is Damien Hirst's Jeff Koons Show Reeks of Power Play. This is from ArtNet News, Hedy Judah, May 19th. Damien Hirst and Jeff Koons have co-curated Now, an exhibition of Koons' work, all from Hirst's collection for the Hirst-owned Newport Street Gallery in London. Coming from these pioneers of the contemporary artist as CEO phenomenon, twin emperors of personal brand building and the generation of art as product, one can't help but sniff around for a power play. Is this a display of collectorial machismo? A tussle for dominance between two art world silverbacks? An Instagram-worthy display of brush-in-hand bromance? In a sense, of course, the power play is right there on the surface, just as in 2008, Hirst cut out the middleman in taking his works directly to auction. Here he offers a similarly streamlined approach to the institutional retrospective. No bandwagon jumping curators, no chummy gallery directors, no self-serving advisory board, no pandering to the moral majority, no loans. Just artists, making art, selling art, buying art, and showing art. In Koons' 2014 retrospective at New York's Whitney Museum, which since toured to the Pompidou in Paris and Guggenheim Bilbao, he's been around. While he's exhibited major series in the UK, Koons' last survey show on these shores of the UK was at Anthony Dufay's gallery back in 1994, so 22 years ago. For a gallery pitching itself firmly at a general domestic audience rather than jaded motion sick riders on the international art world carousel, there's logic to holding a Koons show at Newport Street, not least because, thanks to coverage of prominent exhibitions elsewhere, much of this work that is known in the UK is known in the UK, but has not been seen there. Physical presence is important to Koons. You need to get up close and admire the perfect matte texture on the giant eggshells in Bowl with Eggs, Pink, 1994-2009. The plasticky sheen on the aluminum inflatables, so convincing that you can almost smell vinyl. You need to share space with the Balloon Monkey Blue, 2006-13, to notice how its shine is so high that the edges of its outline blur off in reflective space and it appears to be floating, weightless. The tin-potty cheapness of the stainless steel Italian Woman, 1986, firmly imposes itself up close, as does the color-by-numbers contouring of the oil on canvas Boy with Pony, 1995-2008. When the surface is the subject, it helps if you can actually see the surface. Jeff Koons Now shows a selection of the Koons works that Hirst has collected over the last 12 years, including an example from the early vinyl and mirror inflatable flower series, 1979, which, unlike the eternally bulging metal inflatables, quote-unquote, looks saggy around the edges. Themes of inflation and tumescence thread across the lower floor of the galleries. From the obsolete box fresh vacuum cleaners of the 1990s, The New, a title that seems more ingeniously vainglorious with every passing year, to deadly bronze cast breathing apparatus, through Balloon Monkey, to the artist's own cock, perky as the monkey's tail and shown from two angles, glimpsed lengthwise from the perineum in ice dash Jeff on top pulling out, and side on, slick with saliva and ejaculate in exultation, both from 1991. There's puckering here too, a counterpower to all the blowing and sucking. Placed in adjacent galleries, the wrinkled twists of Balloon Monkey's joints correspond, uncomfortably, to the crimped starburst around Ilona Stoller's anus in the photo work Ice as she parts her cheeks with long-nailed hands. It is in this last room on the ground floor, with the two Made in Heaven pictures and the Bowl of Eggs, that one starts to question the absence of a curator. On the one hand, that they might act as a kind of art world prophylactic, a protecting figure insulated between the artist and post-fellatio pre-heartbreak images of him with his ex-wife. For just how does one go about disinterestedly curating such images of oneself? On the other hand, because for no easily identifiable reason, despite the bright colors and the festive splatters of spunk beneath Stoller's electric blue mascara, the room feels empty and downcast. The upper levels, while they do also show wall-based works and a basketball flotation tank, offer a virtuoso overview of Koons' experiments with cast metal, his subjects becoming more rather than less banal over the course of his career. The sentimental art and kitsch reproduced in the stainless steel from the mid-1980s statuary gives way in the second upper gallery to the inflatable aquatic bestiary of the Popeye series. The technically brilliant seal walrus chairs, 2003-09, pushes the illusion to its outer limit. The titular aluminum inflatables are shown magically sliced through by a stack of plastic chairs. Coons, the erotic narcissist from floor below, has turned into Coons, the showman, Coons, the suburban conjurer, with his merry trope of maritime acrobats. The last room houses a colossal Play-Doh sculpture, sibling to that in the Whitney Show. U.S. critics may have wheeled out psychedelic poop comparisons, but after six rooms of flawlessly executed work, with never the touch of a human hand apparent, Play-Doh would seem to betoken anal fixations of a different kind. Infant Jeff does not strike one as the kind of child to have colored outside the lines. To spend 20 years, 1994 to 2014, developing a monument to smush together modeling clay colors is far more transgressive than anything so suburban as having smutty photos taken with your wife. So this is on view now at the Newport Street Gallery, London, from May 18th to October 16th. And to mark the opening of the new exhibition, Newport Street Gallery has launched its new Summer Lates opening hours, remaining open until 10 p.m. every Saturday, and that's in London. So when you're there, you know, stop by, see the show. And see another retrospective of Jess Koons. But that power play aspect, where you have one of the richest artists in the world collecting another one of the richest artists in the world, that's a real flexing of a muscle there on Damien Hirst's part. Take that as you may. We have another article on Hirst, but I think I'm going to skip in with another with a different article on Julian Schnabel. And this is Julian Schnabel ditches Gagosian for human relationship, quote-unquote, with Pace Gallery. Painter and filmmaker Julian Schnabel has left the stable of mega dealer Larry Gagosian, and he's not afraid to burn the bridge on his way out. Schnabel announced his plans of leaving in a recent interview with the New York Times, this is from the beginning of May, stating that he wanted a deeper connection with the one he had with Gagosian. Quote, I wanted to have a more human relationship with the person who was representing my work, unquote, said the artist. For Schnabel, who recently mounted a joint exhibition with his son Vito, personal relationships are evidently important. Schnabel is taking off and returning to the familiar arms of Pace Gallery, where he reportedly spent 20 years until jumping into the Gagosian ship in 2002. Quote, ultimately is about friendship, quote unquote, the artist told the Times. And ever faithful, Arnie Glimcher, director of Pace, continued to collect Schnabel's artworks despite his departure. Pace, which boasts some 10 locations worldwide, from New York to Beijing, represents major league artists like Chuck Close, David Hockney, Robert Irwin, Agnes Martin, Louise Nevelson, and Kiki Smith. And with a new space in Palo Alto, the gallery is extending its reach. By the way, Gus, there's no Pace in L.A. They failed in L.A. and
They're in Palo Alto.
Well, they just are opening. It's apparently just opening in Palo Alto. But yeah, they're not. Yeah, they're with a new space. But they're not here. They're not in L.A. And Julian Schnabel just had a show at Blum & Poe. And the idea there was, is Pace. I mean, you know, he just got there, but it was Gagosian / Pace going in league with Blum & Poe in Culver City to show Schnabel, and was that an attempt for Blum & Poe to go to mid-career artists, or, you know, really mid-late career in a way, because Schnabel's been on the scene for 30 years. Yeah, interesting, just in note there. So he had a show in L.A., but it's with Blum & Poe. Notably, Schnabel isn't the only artist who claims to be scorned by Gagosian. Mike Kelly told Artillery Magazine in a 2011 interview that the dealer only keeps artists for as long as they make money. Now, you know that Mike Kelly committed suicide, so we really can't get his take on this, unfortunately, and may he rest in peace. So apparently he said, quote, Larry Gagosian, I know, doesn't care about my work, unquote, Kelly said, quote, he's a businessman. It's like you're there as long as he can make money off you, unquote. However, with Damien Hirst making a grand return to Gagosian's empire, we doubt the dealer is mourning the loss too much. So yeah, I reported that last month, that Damien Hirst has gone back to Larry Gagosian, and that's a big coup. And of course, he was featured huge at the Frieze Art Fair in New York last month, and with multiple shows, both at Frieze and at Larry's gallery on Madison Avenue. So just some interesting catch up on some gallery stuff.
Is he really like that? Is he just a businessman?
I've
never met the man.
I don't know him either. But look, he's a very important dealer. And I think he must have a passion for art. I mean, he's been in it for a long, long time and got
more. Is he Armenian?
I don't know his ethnicity.
Just that IAN ending. It's like the Castan, all the Greeks is ISASOS. We're all identifiable.
You know, I'm not sure. I don't know.
Interesting, interesting article though.
Okay. And here's another one. This is another. Let's just wrap this up with another article in Hearst. According to Damien Hearst, you can't make art without money. This is from ArtNet News.
What?
Henry Neuendorf, Thursday, May 19th. Damien Hearst equated money to, quote, love and death, unquote, insisting that it is, quote, something you need to respect, unquote, and that, quote, you can't make art without somehow taking it on board, unquote. Speaking to the BBC in a joint interview with Jeff Koons, ahead of the American Artists Exhibition at Hearst's Newport Street Gallery in Vauxhall, South London, the bad boy of British art addressed a question on whether money obscured artistic creation. I think a lot of people think that artists need to be poor or that you can't have a focus on money, he said. When I did my auction, when I made all that money, it changed everything for me, and it was made in such a short period of time. Yeah, he made $200 million. So, I mean, yeah, I mean, I would have to say that he became one of the richest artists in the world in a heartbeat, and it's bought him everything. I mean, you know,
I can't wait to hear what he says next.
He added, quote, I think money is a huge part of our lives. I've always thought it's as important as love or death or something to come to terms with, something to understand. It's a key, and it's something you need to respect, unquote. As Hearst spoke, the camera showed Jeff Koons looking on understandingly. Hearst insisted, quote, I definitely don't think it, money, should be considered a dirty word. And I think Andy Warhol made it okay for artists to deal with money. I think once that happens, that you can't make art without something taking it on board, unquote. One of the first artists to cut out the gallery, the traditional middlemen, Hearst consigned 223 of his own works to Sotheby's in 2008. According to the New York Times, the two-day auction grossed $200.7 million, setting a new record for a singer-artist auction, surpassing Pablo Picasso's 88-work sale in 1993, which netted $20
million. Doesn't the auction place take a significant point?
Well, they take probably, in this case, they may take 10 or even as much as 20%.
Because it's specialized.
So, yeah, so in this case, he probably made over $150 million. Is set for life.
But usually, like, they'll make usually more than that on.
No, I think they made a special deal.
I'm interrupting. Keep going.
With his considerable wealth, Hearst is currently building massive underground expansion to a $61 million North London mansion that will include a subterranean swimming pool.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, Koons has a somewhat duplicitous relationship to cash. Describing his Luxury and Degradation series, 1986, in an interview ahead of his 2015 exhibition at Vienna's Natural History Museum, he said, quote, I tried to show people that they should learn to preserve their political and economic power rather than strive for luxury, unquote. However, in the same interview, he added, quote, sometimes I take a helicopter to travel to my farm, but I don't live a luxurious lifestyle.
Wow, that's a little nauseating.
Yeah, they're both very...
They're out of touch.
Well, they really made it big in the 90s and 2000.
That's great, but to come up with a rationalization that, I don't know, it seems backwards to me. I'm happy for them, though.
Are those graphs, are those good glitches? Are we recording well?
You know. Okay, not great.
Okay, just making sure. All right, now we've got one more article. Do you remember the gold toilet that I discussed?
Yes.
That's okay.
How could you forget a golden toilet?
Yeah, 18 karat. Okay, so Guggenheim's show delayed with problems with Maurizio Cattelan's solid gold toilet. I thought I'd bring this up because you really enjoyed that last time, so I found another thing on this. Will the Guggenheim's plans for an 18 karat gold toilet become a royal embarrassment? As ArtNet News reported just 2 weeks ago, Italian artist Maurizio Cattelan's solid gold toilet titled America was due to debut in the museum's Upper East Side bathroom today, and that was May 4th, as hordes of art world denizens descended on nearby Randall's Island for the VIP opening of Frieze and other art fairs across Manhattan. But for those wanting the luxury experience of Cattelan's aimed at the 1% commode, the wait will at least be a bit longer. According to the New York Times, quote, serious technical issues are holding up production. No new opening date has been set, and a spokesman for the museum told the Times, quote, it's not days, but I can't be more specific than that right now. The solid gold toilet is a working replica of one made by Wisconsin-based manufacturer Kohler, but Cattelan's team reportedly encountered technical difficulties while trying to make the solid gold dream a reality. Quote, to the museum's knowledge, this kind of casting process has never been done before, the museum spokesman said. The Guggenheim insists that it's not a joke by the mischievous Italian prankster who puts out a magazine called Toilet Paper and whose much-hyped project at Frieze New York this year features a live donkey. And there was a major series of articles about using live animals in art shows and what that does to the animal and the whole scene. So that got a lot of attention, but it also got a little bit of a backlash in that way. The cost of the gold toilet has not been released, though the work is on loan and was paid for with private funds. Now we're just going to do an RIP article. This just came in. This is June 1st. A beloved art collector, Baroness Marianne Lambert, killed in a bus accident. Oh. Art collector Baroness Marianne Lambert died on May 28th, 4 days after being struck by a bus in London. She was 73 years old. She was knocked over by a double-decker as she crossed the road outside Bond Street Station in central London at 4:45 p.m. on Tuesday of last week. 73 years old. Quote, art is the expression of ideas, some of them very foresighted, of lofty ideals, of political insights, and of deep-felt emotions, unquote, she once told an interviewer, according to the Evening Standard, which broke the news. In a statement to ArtNet News, Christie's chairman and head of postwar and contemporary art, Francis Utred, describes Lambert as, quote, intense, visionary, and powerful. He continued, quote, she knew what she wanted in all aspects of life, formidable and kind in equal measure. She will remain in our collective memory as one of the great collectors and a friend who will be deeply missed, unquote. In 2004, Lambert offered approximately 300 photographs at Phillips, Dupuy & Company in a New York auction. The historic sale, which totaled well over $9 million, set new records for artists including Cindy Sherman, Mike Kelly, and Louise Lawler. She was widowed in 2011 by Swiss banking magnate and fellow art collector Philippe Lambert. She reportedly maintained two households in Switzerland and Italy. The Evening Standard reports that Lambert may have been in the UK, well, I know she was, on a visit to her son, Henri. Quote, she was a wonderful woman, a friend told the Standard, very passionate about art and photography, and her death has come as a tragic shock to us all. Lambert's most recent art world venture involved a 2015 Christie's auction of 306 objects, the sale of Visual Odyssey, which culled pieces from her family's holdings, is organized with the help of longtime friend and auctioneer Simon Dupuy. The sale included works by Mark Bradford, Marilyn Minter, and Christopher Wool, among others. She, as she told Adam Lindemann for his book Collecting Contemporary, quote, people who only buy art to invest sooner or later will fall flat on their faces. And that's following an article which I did not bring from the New York Times last Sunday, which is all the art that's just bought on speculation and stored and never shown. And I really should have included that in, and maybe I'll bring it up next month so we can talk about it. We're almost at that.
It's almost halftime?
Yeah, it's almost halftime, but we could do one more article.
Okay.
This being, let's go to film, and let's talk about Cannes Film Festival, or Cannes, however you choose to pronounce it. This is May 23rd. So Ken Loach takes the Palme d'Or at Cannes. Manolo Dargis reports to the New York Times that British director Ken Loach took the top honor of Palme d'Or in the 69th edition of the Cannes Film Festival yesterday for his film I, Daniel Blake. Film story centers on a carpenter with a heart condition facing an impenetrable bureaucracy. Well, there was a famous carpenter, Christ was a carpenter as well.
Going there.
This is not the first time Loach has won this prize at Cannes, or Cannes. His 2006 film, The Wind That Shakes the Barley, set during the Irish War of Independence and the subsequent Irish Civil War, won the Palme d'Or in 2006. The jury for this year's feature competition was led by George Miller and included Arnaud Desplechin, Laszlo Nern, Kirsten Dunst, Valerie Golino, Mads Mikkelsen, that terrific Dutch actor, Vanessa Paradis, Donald Sutherland, and Katayoun Shahabi. The ceremony where Loach received his award also included a tribute to French actor Jean-Pierre Lode, best known for playing Antoine Doniel in François Truffaut's The 400 Blows, with an honorary Palme d'Or presented to him by Desplechin. Among the other recipients, Shahab Husseini received the Best Actor Award for his role in Ashgar, Farhadi's film The Salesman, and the prize for Best Actress was awarded to Jacqueline Joes for her role in Ma Rosa, directed by the Philippine filmmaker Brillante Mendoza. The Best Director prize was jointly given to the Romanian director Christian Mungui and the French director Olivier Assayas. The jury prize went to the British director Andre Arnold for her film American Honey. Canadian filmmaker Xavier Dolan won the Grand Prix for It's Only the End of the World. And Finnish director Juho Kuzmanen took home the En Certain Regard reprise for a film called The Happiest Day in the Life of Ali Maki. So that's a little bit of film news that we thought we'd throw in there. And you want to play a song? You know, let's play a song. So this is going to be The Golden Age.
Golden Age.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Welcome back to Mind the Gap with Gus Costanis. This is Jason Vass. That was The Golden Age by Beck. We're talking about art and other assorted things, LA, California, US, nation.
Earth, the planet.
Yeah, Europe and Earth, small globe spinning in the void of space. So I've got a bunch of stuff. We're going to start with just a people thing. A vagina kayak artist found guilty of obscenity in Tokyo court. This is the beginning of May.
Did you say vagina kayak artist?
Yeah, this is a woman. I talked about her in some show about a year ago. This is a woman who took some photos of her vagina, made a kayak, so the opening is like the opening of it, and the kayak is vagina, and then paddle around Tokyo or something, and somehow this offended. As you know, in all Japanese images of genitalia, they always obscure it. They block it out so that you can't really see it. So they felt that this was somehow against the law. So this is an article. Vagina kayak artist found guilty of obscenity in Tokyo court. This is from ArtNet News, Lorena Munoz Alonso. This was dated Monday, May 9th. Concluding a protracted case that began 2 years ago. So this has been in the news for a long time. A Tokyo district court today found vagina kayak artist Megumi Igarashi guilty of distributing obscene images. The Guardian reports that the 44-year-old was slapped with a 400,000 yen fine, approximately $3,500, half the amount demanded by prosecutors. Japan's obscenity laws carry a maximum penalty of 2 years in prison, but back in February, case prosecutors decided to only demand a fine of 800,000 yen. Igarashi was cleared of another charge related to the displaying of obscene material in an adult shop in Tokyo, namely plaster versions of the vagina kayak. The ruling ends a case that goes back to July 2014 when Igarashi was arrested for trying to raise funds online to pay for the construction of a vagina-shaped kayak, which was realized using a 3D printer. And there's pictures of her using photographs of herself, and then the decision to use those photographs to make the 3D version, the 3D model. Okay. Quote, "I don't believe my vagina is anything I've seen," unquote, Igarashi stated in a press conference upon being released. Quote, "I was determined I would never yield to police power," she declared. In December 2014, however, Igarashi, whose artistic moniker Rukude Nashiko, which means something similar to reprobate child, was arrested a second time on suspicion of having sent a link, quote, "that shows her plan to create a boat using three-dimensional obscene data to numerous people." Igarashi's case has highlighted Japan's rather contradictory stance on pornography. Although the country has a buoyant pornography industry, its laws forbid the depiction of actual genitalia, which usually appear censored or pixelated. For the artist, her case also revealed the level of misogyny present in the country. Quote, "Works that focus on female gender themes are looked down upon in Japan," she told ArtNet News last year. Throughout her ordeal with the Japanese authorities, Igarashi has emerged as a strong advocate for women's rights and freedom of expression, supported and respected by many across the world. The Guardian reports that an English translation of her book, quote, "What is Obscenity?" will go on sale. That was in May. So she has a book that she's written about what is obscenity, and clearly I don't believe it's obscene, but...
But is it art? Of course it's art, but is it interesting? I wish our audience could see your expressions.
I think that it might be. Here's an interesting article also about women. This is May 17th. I don't know where I got it, but Cheyenne Westfall was appointed chair of Phillips Auction House. I think this is important. So Annie Shaw of the Art Newspaper, that's where it came from, writes that Cheyenne Westfall, the former international head of contemporary art at Sotheby's, has been appointed chairman of Phillips. She will be replacing Ed Dolmanu, who will continue to serve as CEO of the company and will start sometime in 2017. Westfall started at Sotheby's in 1990. She was responsible for helping to put together the 2008 Damien Hirst auction titled Beautiful Inside My Head Forever, which brought the auction house over $175 million. Her hire is part of an expanded efforts at Phillips to broaden its contemporary art interests. So Cheyenne Westfall appointed chairman of Philips.
Wait, chairman?
Chairperson.
Okay.
This is an article that I think is an interesting business-related market in the art world article. And this is called, this is Padelate and Auctionata announce surprise merger. So auction, online auction startups, I guess they're still startups, Padelate and Auctionata have announced today that the two companies will join forces and will cater to what they define in a statement as an, quote, underserved, unquote, middle market. Both Padelate and Auctionata have independently pursued the middle sector of items valued up to $500,000. Auctionata in Europe with live streamed auctions of vintage luxury items, and Padelate in the United States with curated auctions and benefit sales of contemporary art. In 2015, the two companies reported combined sales totaling over $150 million. Their joint user base numbers are just under 800,000, with registered accounts in 200 countries. According to the press release, the newly formed company will thus lay claim to being one of the top auction houses in the world outside of China. Quote, "This merger allows us to allocate greater resources toward innovating at every step of the collecting process, from online valuation services to post-sale fulfillment, and to expand our current offerings in terms of both categories and sales channels," said Aditya Julka, co-founder of Padelate, in a statement. Sorry if I've mangled your name. While the financial terms of the deal were not disclosed, the companies confirmed that all co-founders will remain in strategic and operational roles. That's been updated. I did see something where there were lots of people leaving. I should have found that article. I just chose not to. Yeah, I just was talking about the merger. But now that I think about it, recently I saw there were lots of people leaving.
Well,
so
anytime.
Yeah, we knew that was going to happen. At the merger, they always say, oh, everyone's going to be here.
Redundancy.
Yeah. So they claim that all co-founders remain in strategic and operational roles. Alexander Zaki, previously CEO of Auctionata, will lead the global management team of the newly formed group, which will carry the names of both the Padelate and Auctionata brands. This past April, Ardenshire Hiscox released its annual report on the online market, for which it surveyed some 672 art buyers, who ranked Padelate as fifth and Auctionata as ninth among existing online art buying platforms. ArtNet, by the way, is listed third. Both companies have raised funds from high-profile investors, which will all remain involved with the new, as yet unnamed company. Fashion billionaire Bernard Arnault is an investor in Auctionata, which has raised $88 million in equity capital to date. Padelate, meanwhile, has raised $44 million with investors, including artist Damien Hirst and dealers David Zwirner and Jay Jopling. Although deeply connected to the art world, Padelate's most talked about auction was of the sole copy of the Hu-Tang Clan's final album, which went for $2 million to former pharmaceutical executive Martin Shkreli, and carried with it a protracted copyright lawsuit. News of the fusion comes on the heels of a negative report by the auditors KPMG, in which the management of Auctionata was accused of serious trade violations. So that's it on the art news this month that I felt was worth talking about, except we might touch on a couple of things I said.
I think it's funny. I mean, almost we're talking about the reactions of money and art. I mean, that's really most of what we talk about on this show.
Talk about artists and
but
and
of
lawsuits.
There's a lot of economics on.
I bring economics into it because art is a commerce.
But that's certainly what's written about.
It is, and we see a lot of that, and I bring it into it. We don't always talk about all of the conceptual aspects of it. That's true. We could bring that. Thank you for bringing that.
From my point of view, it's just like I love the idea of money and art. Bring it to me. But there's certainly art without money. I mean, that's. I think
to Damien Hirst,
I think it's mostly without money, and most of the artwork that's created isn't bought, I think.
Well, it's tough right now. I can tell you that
it's tough everywhere.
well, in certain sectors, yeah.
Well, I mean, just
it's tough in that middle ground in art, though. I'll tell you that it's a tough slog right now. It really is, and we don't need to run away from it. So we could talk about the making of art and the dissemination of it, and how many artists struggle so much to survive.
I mean, it's like we always talk in I did a lot of casting in television and with actors, and it's like the 2%, the 1.5% that work, and 97% of the people in SAG are struggling. That's 97% of the people who are in the group of people that can only work. So, I mean, it just spreads through all fields of art. And
music, do you feel as well?
Much more, especially now with music, because there is no distribution left. I mean, at least there's galleries with artists, and there's endless television shows and commercials for actors. But musically, I mean, for myself, my point of view, it's the same subject. As I've always created music for myself and for people to listen to, but not from the point of view of trying to make money from it, because if I did that, I'd be extraordinarily frustrated, because then why do it? I mean, you got to do something just for the point of doing it to a certain degree, and isn't that really how art started? Or isn't that, I mean, I don't know. I feel like now I'm on the other side here.
No, art definitely was made to, because an artist couldn't help but do it, and he or she needed to do it. And you,
well, that, I mean, you, I mean, ultimately, if we go way back,
creative expression.
We're going to go back to
what, cave?
Yeah, I mean, that's, there was a purpose to that. It was probably economic to a certain degree.
Well, it was pictorial and it was story. It's a storytelling. You're telling a story. It's autobiographical. It's the tribe. It's your whole clan. It's your group. There's also beauty. There's an aesthetic quality to art too. Yeah. So there's a lot of things that go into art, and there's a lot of reasons that why one would make it and why one would want to appreciate it, and certainly the remunerative aspect of it is a part of our world. All the artists that I encounter, many of them are doing it because they have to and they want to and they need to, and they've been doing it. But there's also a validation and a need to make money. I mean, you want to be recognized not just by your peers, but by critics and collectors, and have a value. And if you could earn a living and have a nice life and doing something that you love to do and that you are driven to do and that you have to do, then it's a win-win-win situation.
But so, I think it's very much like the acting situation where, yeah, it's great, but it's like we're talking about 2%, right? The people that are able to just do artwork and live off of it. I mean, that's probably high. That's probably high.
It's in every generation, there's only a handful that hit the top. And there's a lot of working stiffs who are doing it and who eke out an existence and hopefully achieve some level. I was going to read about the top auction results for artists, and I just could not get it. I couldn't print the thing out without printing like a dozen pages. So I just gave up. But I wanted to share some of that. Those more numbers. Well, I do it regularly, but this was the latest. There was the latest iteration of top auction, the top 100 people at auction, the top women. I cover a lot of different subjects over the last number of years. But before we don't need to go, but I just wanted to read some stuff. This is the out of the New York Times. This is called The Social Cues. And
read.
Yeah. So this is Philip Galanes, Galanes, Philip Galanes. And we enjoy these. Usually when I read them, you like them. So I figured we haven't read this in a while. We haven't shared any of these in a while. So I thought I'd have it here. This is called
We love the New York Times.
Yeah. Well, and this is a good, this is The Social Cues. So this is called The Eyes Have It. I went sliding into a banquette in a crowded restaurant or into a row of seats at the theater. Is it better to face the people you pass, placing your crotch at eye level, or look away from them, putting your derriere in their faces? Elizabeth, New York. So what's your thought on that? Is it better?
I think it has to do with genetics. It's how round is the backside.
Well, all of that may be. What do you do? Do you shuffle along with your ass in their faces, or do you shuffle along looking at them?
I wonder if it's that same thing where Arabs don't shake hands with their right hand because of what they're, I mean, culturally, I think it would be odd to face people while I shimmied by them.
All right, well, he's written here, the eyes have it.
Okay.
So what's he implying? That you look at them. You don't put your back to them, you look at them. So this is what he writes. I have been waiting for this one. And it seems to me like this is a repeat because I felt like I read this already.
But, I mean, I think this is just...
This is just his opinion.
All right.
And it only took 8 years of me writing this article. We'll just read it.
Step back 8 years.
And it only took 8 years to arrive. This question, he's been waiting 8 years. And right. I think he's pretty droll. I prefer facing people as I slither in and out of tight spots. This allows for eye contact and fleeting, semi-apologetic acknowledgments that we are sharing close quarters. More important, it also lets us navigate with greater precision to avoid stepping on the toes of fellow theatergoers or knocking hot sauce onto the Givenchy's of people at neighboring tables with the backs of our jackets. So I think it's a fine line there with what you feel is right. I mean, in movie theaters, we tend to shuffle along facing the audience with our asses in their faces so we don't look at them, so we don't see them. On the other hand, it's a fine line there between shuffling the other way and looking at them and seeing their bodies, their feet, and what their reactions are. So get to the theater early. Get to the banquet. Don't slide along with anyone. Always be in your seat and have other people doing it to you. And who cares if it's their backs or their fronts? But I thought that that would be...
I personally, I sit on the aisle just for that reason.
Well, if there's no aisle seat and there's only two in the middle...
And I don't go to the movie.
Well, you don't go to the movies anyway, right? When was the last time you went to the movie?
I went this year.
Well, okay, that's exciting. You went this year.
I mean, I don't see how going to the
it's
movie...
It's June.
Me
we're
talking
in month
about
six.
Going to the movie can anyway it's, be exciting.
Well, okay. Well, I think our listeners are excited.
He sat down. The movie started. He watched the movie.
He left teary-eyed or...
Well, with me, it's probably teary-eyed, but that's just myself.
All right. This is another one he wrote. It's called An Evening of Wine and Roses, spelled W-H-I-N-E. Okay.
Wine.
My brother is married to a lovely woman. We take turns dining at each other's homes. She is an excellent cook, but serves extremely bad wine. I arrive with a fine, expensive bottle. She thanks me for it, then whisks it away and brings out the cheap swill.
Oh, she doesn't even open it.
Would I be committing a social sin if I asked her to serve the bottle I brought?
Can't wait to hear this.
From my vantage, as no Pierre Franet, buying an expensive bottle of Chablis is magnificently easier than cooking an excellent dinner.
Wow.
Perhaps this is coloring our fundamental disagreement about the nature of hostess gifts. You are bringing the wine to thank your sister-in-law for her blood, sweat, and grocery shopping, not to consume it yourself. Wow. If you brought her peonies, would you expect to leave with a few stems? Call your sister-in-law before the next dinner and say, quote, I've become interested in wine pairings. Would you mind if I brought a bottle that goes especially well with your menu tonight? And then share that menu. If she agrees, bring two bottles, one for the table and another as a hostess gift. Otherwise, not another pinot peep.
Excellent.
All right.
Excellent. So, right? Put in your place.
Right. So that's for all the people who, like myself included, who bring really good wine and then they put it away. And you're like, what the hell? I wanted to drink some of that. That's why I brought it. But it's a gift. So you can't expect if you brought another gift to take part of that gift.
You could always bring it with a bottle opener and just sort of wrap it around it.
Well, as other people open them right away. So it's all in who you go to visit. But in this case, they're serving the cheap. But I like his responses. Okay.
Well, but, you know, the cheap wine means that the price of wine is the value of wine. And that in itself is a stilted point of view, isn't it? I mean, I've seen lots of $30 bottles of wine that aren't as good as $10 bottles of wine. Tasted.
That's true. But he knows.
And this is right the same thing. The value of art, the value of money.
The value of friendship. The value of
yes.
camaraderie. The value of those dinners.
And she did cook an excellent meal, I would think.
Well, he said.
And that's a lot harder to do.
He said she is an excellent cook. All right. Every day is a holiday.
Okay.
Last year, our new neighbors lit holiday decorations on their front yard until the beginning of April.
Front yard.
Yeah, front yard until the beginning of April. This year, they doubled the number of decorations, and they are still up.
Christmas, I imagine.
Yeah. Is there any way to ask them politely to take down the decorations if they don't come down soon?
I can't wait to hear this one.
I've got it. Knock on your neighbor's door and ask them if you can buy their place. If they agree, decorate as and when you like after the deal closes.
Otherwise,
keep still. Absent local ordinance, they are free to power up their twinkly lights on the 4th of July, and you are free to avert your gaze. It's called private property for a reason, even though everyone knows that you and I would do a better job.
Well written. You know, I think maybe we should just do a few shows dedicated just to these articles.
This guy. Awesome. I know. I told you always like them. You forget how much you like them. Okay. Worried, sick. Yeah. 3 years ago, a close friend and I had a big falling out. I tried to mend things, but our relationship has never been the same. We say hello, but rarely converse. I heard she is now undergoing chemotherapy. I feel the need to go to her and offer support. If her relationship had not soured, she would be confiding in me. Should I speak to her or pretend I know nothing? I know your heart is in the right place, but serious illness is a nasty business, and people who are sick should be allowed to confide in whom they choose, not forced to dodge folks who want to insert themselves, however supportively, in their crisis. Complicating matters, we don't know how your friend feels about you post-blowout. If she still harbors resentment, your speaking with her may cause even more stress, the last thing we want. Err on the side of safety and let her make the first move. Her need to take care of herself trumps your desire to speak.
God, these are all similar in that they're about an individual ego versus a collective, what's better.
That's right. Do you want to play some music or do you want to read one more? Up to you.
Quick one.
Okay. A quick one. All right. My husband is... Okay, this one's called In the Extrovert's Light.
Okay.
My husband is outgoing. He enjoys striking up conversations with strangers and engages people whenever possible. I am quieter and often fall into the role of second banana. I'm okay with that. But a few of our mutual friends have a habit of that annoys me. They direct their comments only to my husband, rarely even glancing at me. I am not silent during those conversations. I look directly at the speaker and nod my head to show I'm engaged, but to no avail. Any ideas about letting these friends know that their behavior is boorish? Enlist the aid of the extrovert in chief. Explain the problem to your husband and ask him to shine his light your way. With periodic questions as simple as, "What do you think, Martha?" he will remind others that you and your opinions are well worth listening to. Make sure to take him up on these invitations. One of the great kindnesses of extroverts, whose charisma can be the engine of conversations, is inviting those who may be more reticent into the circle of fun. Otherwise, their charm takes on a selfishness that makes interactions all about them. With luck, your husband is not all me, me, me.
And that's what the issue really is.
Yeah. So with that, we're going to end the show.
We're going to hear a few bars of
Teenage Riot, Sonic Youth, and All Well. Shout outs to all our listeners, whomever you may be. May you have a great June, and we'll see you, and we'll be back on in July.
I'll be back with a new shoulder.
All right.